Today is Tuesday, July 24th, the year 2001. I am Jeff Charnley, interviewing Dr. Chitra Smith for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial to be commemorated 4 years from now in the year 2005. Dr. Smith, you can see that we have a tape recorder here for this session. Do you give us permission to record the interview?
Yes, I do.
Okay. I'd like to start with some personal and educational information, questions relating to that. Where were you born and raised, and where did you go to school?
Fairly weird history. I was born in Jerusalem, which was then called Palestine rather than Israel. But I was a Czech. I mean, my parents were Czech and returned. I grew up in Prague. I was sent off to boarding school in England in March 39. From boarding school, I went to Oxford, where I got a degree in history. After that, I went to work for the American Occupation Army in 1945. No, that's not right. You don't want all my whole occupational history, do you?
Of course.
All right, my first job out of college was in adult education. The university had a so-called delegacy for extramural studies, which means extension division. Mm-hmm. And my first job after graduation was in adult education. And by this time, it was World War II. And I taught classes to people like aircraft production workers and firemen and people in basic training at a nearby air base. See, and I did adult education courses on stuff like the title that I devised for one I thought was really quite prophetic. You know, these would be 12 evening courses. I had one that I called Britain, America, and Russia - Allies for how long?
That was in 45 or 46?
That was in 44.
44?
Oh, yes. Wow.
Mm-hmm. So even anticipating what was happening or what happened right after the war. So you were in England during the Blitz?
Yes.
And during,
oh, yes.
You in London?
No, I was in Bristol, or in the suburbs of Bristol. But I do have some wartime memories that are quite picturesque in that I was doing what was then called school certificate leaving exams, high school leaving exams, which are now called O-levels or A-levels or what have you. And at my school in Bristol, we were doing our school certificate, meaning very important, you know, this captures your high school record exams. And the air raid would start, and we would be shepherded into the basement. We all had to turn over the test papers, go down to the basement. Then, you know, it usually didn't take very long, half an hour, 45 minutes later, the all clear sounded. The matron at the head of the stairs with milk and cookies. And then you'd go back and turn the exam over and continue, you know. So not everybody took his final high school exams under these conditions.
I guess not.
Then I went to Oxford from there. At Oxford, I was politically extremely active. I was chairman of what was called the Labour Club, but there were two socialist clubs, and the Labour Club was not the Labour Party type, not the Social Democrats, but the very leftist, more or less fellow traveling variant of a socialist club. Mm-hmm. So the Labour Club was by far the largest political organization in the university. Mm-hmm. And many, many famous people got their start there. And for me, with my eccentric foreign name and my quite noticeable accent, to be chairman of this very large political body was distinctive.
Who Who were some of the people that that either later became famous that you knew or, or in that club, any that you recall?
The one that only comes to mind immediately is Iris Murdoch, because she was well known as a major novelist. I've forgotten the names. They'll come to me as I read The Economist or something. It'll come to me. Mm-hmm. I may send you a note about who they were.
I forgot to ask, what was your maiden name?
Well, the male version is easy, Rudinger. Mm-hmm. But since all Czech females have an OVA tacked onto their name, it was Rudingerova. Okay? Just as it sounds, Rudingerova. Mm-hmm. But in the Slavic languages, you can't just dispense with the OVA because it makes no difference in England. Mm-hmm. You know, you feel funny if you... A female, it's as though you were a transvestite if you don't, mm-hmm. add the OVA. Mm-hmm. So,
what languages did you study?
Well, I was brought up by my parents bilingually in Czech and German. Mm-hmm. They were very hot on not being provincial. And my mother had studied in England in World War I, and she spoke very fluent English. So she taught us English at home. At school we had, well, German, Czech, German, Latin, and French. So I spoke French, you know, not elegantly, but serviceably. Mm-hmm. I still speak German badly, but fluently. Same with Czech. So when I went to England, I could speak English fluently, but with a very noticeable accent. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't have gone if my mother hadn't taught us, you know, I picked up the, you know, senior level curriculum in English without any trouble when I went to England from Prague. Wait, there was something else involved here about languages. Oh, yeah. My family had a history of being very good at languages. And my mother grew up bilingually in German and Hungarian because her family had a winter home in Vienna and a summer home in Budapest or on the lake in Hungary. My father was really a linguistic genius. He could swear in about 8 or 9 languages, but but he could have cultivated conversations in 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. You know, so this was taken very seriously in our family. And when my father wound up in jail during the early communist era. He decided with all his spare time, what would one do with it? Well, the answer was obvious, learn another language. So he learned Russian in jail, and which he then put to good use when he finally got let out. Hey, you don't want to know.
No, it's very interesting. In many of the interviews that I've done, many World War II shaped many of the people that I spoke with.
It's true of Walter Adams.
Isn't that important as a, understanding you as a scholar and your experience at Michigan State, in understanding that perspective is important. And how the war especially shaped, and the post-war period, was this university was shaped by World War II in many regards.
It's very true. It's very
and
true.
I think many people today forget or overlook that. And yet, I think your World War II experience during the war is critical.
Yeah.
Your parents, did both survive the war?
They both survived the war in England. They both went to England as refugees and worked, because they both spoke English fluently, so for them it was a very interesting time. It was not a time of deprivation or anything. Mm-hmm. In fact, our whole family had what in England they call we had a good war. That is not an insignificant sort of turn of phrase, because I don't think the English have ever been as admirable before or since during that war. And I mean the degree of social cohesion, of solidarity, of genuine mutual consideration under these constrained conditions, was absolutely superb. I mean, it was a, you've never seen human nature so beautifully expressed by a whole people as you did during that time. Mm-hmm. Because
do you think that it shook the social class structure?
It was ready to be shaken. Mm-hmm. I mean, there had been between the wars, the labor unrest had been pretty serious, and there was an absolute social consensus in England that during the rationing and the blackouts and so on, we're never going back to the same thing. That was a universal notion in England. And then along came Sir William Beveridge, who was, well, technically a liberal. He was a leader of the Liberal Party. He was also, I think he was Master of University College at Oxford. In any case, the Beveridge plan that he concocted was the sort of brave new world of the fairer, juster England that we were going to have after the war. And it was essentially what you would call today a social democrat agenda of welfare statism, of free university education, of the National Health Service was part of that plan. And this is why Churchill didn't last after the war as a political leader, because people by that time, again, there was an extraordinary degree of consensus. People knew what they wanted. And it wasn't what the Conservative Party was selling, you know. It was...
Did you ever see Churchill in person?
Yes.
What was that circumstance?
That is a good anecdote. It has the advantage of being absolutely true. VE Day, which was May 1945, the friend with whom I shared an apartment, we had been friends at Oxford, and we were roommates in London when we were working in London. And we did what we decided we would do, what everybody else did, just go out in the streets to celebrate. And so we wandered out. We lived in Bayswater. We wandered a long time until we got to Whitehall. And there, the streets were absolutely packed with people, waiting and yelling for Churchill. And he was, you know, it was known he was indoors. And he came out on a balcony. And he waved, and people screamed, and everybody was ecstatic. And he made a very, you know, 100-word little remark. But he seemed to be really blind drunk by this time. I mean... amiably, but and what the only thing I remember about the speech, it was a speech, the remark. They talked about, I'm not making this up, my friend Dorothy Wartenberg will testify to this. He talked about the bird of freedom chirping in our hearts. And all these decades, I thought he was drunk until I read some biographical piece about him recently, which said that he had a serious stutter as a younger person. Uh-huh. Yeah. And it may be that he had only a reasonable amount to drink, uh-huh, and that stutter reasserted itself. Yeah. So in any case, I heard him talk about chirping in our hearts.
Interesting. What did you study at Oxford?
History.
History. Yes. Yes. any great teachers or influential teachers that you had, or memorable teachers?
Yes, mm-hmm. Two or three. The man who taught the most memorable, I guess, was my moral tutor, which is what we called, what they called, the university called, academic advisors, mm-hmm, which I think is a nice notion, you know. My moral tutor was a medievalist called Mrs. Agnes Lees, L-E-Y-S. She was married to a guy who had a living, you know, a clergyman who had a living somewhere, but he never went there. You know, this is very 19th century England, so. Mm-hmm. In any case, Mrs. Lees was a lovely, lovely lady who was what one would call today a sort of a Christian socialist, you know. Mm-hmm. And she really kept an eye on her girls. And when it came to picking my special subject, which is what we would call the honors of a senior thesis, you know, everybody did one in those days. And there was a list of 14 topics the university had approved. And the most modern, this is in history now, modern history I majored in. The most recent was William Peel's economic policy, 1848, 46 to 48, okay? So this is the most modern. You have to visualize me as, you know, I spent all my life on my political activities in this labor club, the socialist club. So I would do the most recent and the most economic, you know? So I said, that's what I would do. And Mrs. Lees, who knew exactly what I was doing with most of my time, said, no, my dear, you're getting quite enough of that sort of thing. She said, I think the time has come for you to spend a little time in the company of a great mind. And therefore, thou shalt do St. Augustine and the Decline of the Roman Empire. And then she added as an afterthought, and that was really what was behind it. She wanted to brag to her buddies that she had someone who could do it. And she said, anyway, you're the only one of my girls who can handle the Latin. So I did St. Augustine, mm-hmm. and I got a good Marxist fix on the causes of the decline of the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. It stuck with me as a fascinating subject. I have a 3-volume Gibbon sitting next to my bed. And when I can't sleep, you know, and I've finished all my mysteries and my political journals and so forth, I pick up my Gibbon and I read a few pages before I go to sleep. So anyway,
We're talking about your education at Oxford and how it shaped you as a scholar.
I know you asked, significant teachers. Mm-hmm. Yes, Mrs. Lees. I never had what we would call a course with, a tutorial with, but she was extremely significant. I had a Pusey House High Church cleric who was the expert on St. Augustine. And he was a guy who went around here in black skirts and silver buckles on his shoes. I mean, really very... Mm-hmm. Pusey House was the foundation that served Anglicans or Church of England people mm-hmm. who were really Catholic in all but name. Mm-hmm. You know, they had essentially this very, very high church, mm-hmm. Quasi-para-Catholic thing. And he was the university's expert on St. Augustine. I mean, I was very lucky to get there. Mm-hmm. And that man was absolutely brilliant in that. He never called me on my half-baked Marxism, but he made me see, you know, all I won't say errors, the unexamined assumptions that go into a Marxist interpretation of history. Mm-hmm. See, so he was the one who probably subverted my basic political. Ideological certainties. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a crisis for me or anything. It was just interesting, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah. And so he was one, and then the
what
other.
What was his name?
Oh God! Oh. I'll have to.
We can look it up.
It'll come to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, with these memory things, mm-hmm. what happens is once you've activated the topic, mm-hmm. it'll come back.
Yes.
But you don't know whether it's going to be 5 minutes or 5 days. You know.
I know.
So I will make sure that I figure out who he was.
And we can add that to the
record. Yes, we could add this. And the other one was a guy I tutored, we used to call it. If you went to a man for your tutorials, that mm-hmm. was in the days when you really did have individual tutorials once a week. And that was the ideal traditional Oxford system, where you were given an essay to write, and you worked furiously reading and writing for a week. Then you handed it in the night before so he could read it, and then you went in for your hour's tutorial, where he would then tear it apart and go from there, and, you know. So that was basically the major part of your university career, was reading and writing these weekly papers and then spending an hour having them reviewed and discussed by an expert, a real expert. And the other half was lectures. And on lectures, you nobody made you go to any lectures. It was just a matter of whether you wanted to go or not. Mm-hmm. And you could go for one of two reasons. Either because you were very instrumental about this and very calculating, and you knew that 3 years from now you would have to write some very searching exam papers and all this stuff, so maybe you better get from the horse's mouth, and, you know. That's one reason. The other was that you just heard this guy was so interesting, or he had such a wonderful topic or something, that you wanted to go hear him. Mm-hmm. So, being me, I mostly did the latter, and I had a wonderful time, even on unpromising things like Stubbs Charters was a big book of pre-Norman English Anglo-Saxon constitutional documents. Mm-hmm. And, you know, proverbial is the dullest thing you could possibly imagine. Mm-hmm. But to me it didn't seem dull, you know. Mm-hmm. So, because he had such very interesting things to say about, in effect, what we would say today about the social dynamics that led to these constitutional arrangements, mm-hmm, and inventions, you know. Mm-hmm. So I used to go to lectures a lot more than my friends. Mm-hmm. But the central part of your genuine educational experience was not the great lectures. I mean, I can do that today, you know. Mm-hmm. But this business of spending an hour a week rethinking the best you could devise on a subject you had read about a lot, and then spending an hour in conversation about that with somebody who was a certified, proven expert on the subject, that was the core of our education, you know. It's a wonderful system, but of course very expensive.
One-on-one, yeah.
Yeah.
What did you do for graduate work?
I think I better tell you my guilty secret. I never finished graduate work. Mm-hmm. I never even started graduate work until years and years later. I didn't see any need for it. There were so many other exciting things to do. So, I don't know if you know, at Oxford you automatically have an MA bestowed on you 4 years later, as mm-hmm long as you remain a member of the university. So I had this MA. But when I came here and started teaching in university college, or in basic college, that's all I had. And then, I don't know whether I should say this, no, I won't say this on for the record. I was going to name names about who started pressuring me about, you've got to get a PhD, we can't promote you without. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't have time for a PhD. And my mentor said, it doesn't have to be a good PhD, just get one in education. just get it, you know, nobody will ask what it's in. You've got a record in this university that you can stand on, but it's just, we need this for the... So, to cut a long story short, I resisted this. Then I went to Indonesia for a year with my husband, and I got so... He was on a research assignment, and I was along for the ride. And while we were in Indonesia, I got so fascinated with development economics as a discipline, as a field. And of course, you have to remember, I had been teaching in a multidisciplinary social science program, mm-hmm, and I was very much committed to the insight-producing nature of multidisciplinary, what we used to call interdisciplinary study. So development economics is an absolutely classic case where you cannot get to first base understanding economic development unless you take a very close look at the culture, anthropological, you know, the values, the orientations, the priorities, anthropology, sociology for the social structure and who's powerful and who's poor and so forth. political science for how is power exercised and by whom. So that development economics was the ultimate quintessential interdisciplinary social science topic. And this began to interest me so much, I was prepared suddenly to do a PhD. I was going to do a dissertation on a really important subject. Mm-hmm. And the subject was going to be, can a culture, a country, I mean Indonesia was what I then knew best, become modern and prosperous without sacrificing its culture, its values, its traditions, its rather exquisite rules of social conduct? You see, the question was, can you get the good without the bad of modernity? Mm-hmm. That basically, that was what I was going to do. But to do that, I realized, would involve manufacturing a unified theory of social science, which of course didn't exist and doesn't exist, mm-hmm. doesn't begin to exist, even though in the 50s and 60s there were people like Talcott Parsons who thought they could produce such a thing, but they didn't. In any case, so I was going to produce one of those, and I did an absolute minimum of coursework, because my coursework by this time was all read it yourself with a friend in charge, you know. Mm-hmm. I have what is known as an ABD in multidisciplinary social science at MSU, which means I have done everything except the dissertation. I even had orals, you know. But I don't know whether to tell you this on the record, because it's not fair to give the impression that the university was handing these out. I think, to my knowledge, I'm the only person who ever did it that way. Mm-hmm. But most of the experts were colleagues whom I knew well, and some were friends. And so I took most of these courses by independent study with an occasional chat. Mm-hmm. And my orals were presided over by Bill Ross, who was an anthropologist who was also director of the Asian Studies Center, of which I was a founding member, you know. I mean, I became an Asianist as a result of that experience in Indonesia. And so Bill Ross and some other friends sat around and we chatted, and that was my orals. And it was lovely and it was great fun. So then I said, now I will start my dissertation. Cut a long story short, I worked very hard. And after about 3 years, you know, there was no rush. I had a perfectly good tenured husband. We didn't depend on my income for anything. We lived very simply. We never had great aspirations, you know, to. So the first time I remember we really needed money, by this time I was making what to me seemed a lot of money, was when we decided the children should be able to go to school anywhere. They didn't have to go to a place that was cheap.
Mm-hmm. For a university? Their university,
yes.
Education?
Yeah, for their university education, right. Mm-hmm. And they headed in very different directions, but more about that. That's not part of what we're talking about. But the dissertation and the way the university coped with me was interesting. I was just, my husband used to say rather scornfully, this was not necessarily flattering, he said, you were just born lucky. I mean, you have luck no matter what the issue is, you know. In fact, his favorite name for me was you luck chut, which was a corruption of my name. So I was very lucky. I was given this very pleasurable way of doing graduate work. And I did do a full, you know, as I look back on it. Mm-hmm. I didn't cut any corners. It's just that it looks fishy.
Well, it sounds more like you continued the Oxford style of education.
Exactly.
Here, which if you had that flexibility, I see.
It's true, but also it was sort of potentially corrupt, uh-huh. because by this time, I had peer relationships with all these mm-hmm. people who were my tutors, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and that is not good. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually.
Yeah. How? Let's go back a little bit. But how was it that you came to Michigan State?
We had a fairly interesting life. My husband was a political scientist. His specialization was in international relations, which was at that time a branch of political science. His name was Bruce L. Smith. I met him in Germany, where he was working for the OSS and State Department on a liaison deal, looking for war criminals. I mean, he was looking for them to interview for you know, our version of oral history, find these super Nazis, and they were in jail. I mean, most of them were in jail. Mm-hmm. And if you found them, you had them put in jail. Mm-hmm. And then Bruce used to interview them in jail. He would go for 2 or 3 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. So were the interviews transcribed, but with a physical transcript?